Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org.
Whether or not you believe the old adage that sex sells, turns out what's really doing the buying is your brain. We're going to discuss the new and powerful world of neuromarketing and the art of advertising on today's Virginia Conversations. I'm Lily Lee. Thanks for joining us. It was second-guessing a simple television ad campaign that led Dr. Reed Montague into the unknown science of neuromarketing. Reed is with the Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute and joins us in the studio to explain his work. Also with us is Thomas Becker, Senior Vice President with NeedHawk, Dubuque, and Packet, an advertising agency with offices in Richmond, Roanoke, Chattanooga, Durham, and Tampa. Well, welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I'm going to start with you, Reed. Our listeners remember back in the late 70s, early 80s, there was the Pepsi Challenge, and these were the blind taste tests between Coke and Pepsi, and usually people preferred the taste of Pepsi. Some 30 years later, Reed, you were still thinking about those taste tests. If people prefer the taste of Pepsi, then why didn't Pepsi dominate the market? So we're here to talk about decision-making and social cognition and your work in that field. And really, we should say your daughter helped a lot in this early endeavor.
Indeed, she did. Of course, it was being interested in that was a confluence of a bunch of things. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, the home of Coca-Cola. So when I saw those ads, I thought, I've never seen anybody enjoy Pepsi more than a Coca-Cola. So I thought something was wrong. It sort of sat in my head for a long time. Anyway, my daughter, my oldest daughter, who's now even older, was 16 at the time and came to my lab to work as an intern for the summer. And I had to give her something to do. And there's a lot of physics and math and statistics and things involving imaging the brain and doing experiments like that. But I needed something where she could ask a legitimate question but didn't have to go into all those kinds of details. And we were very interested in how the brain values the world around you and how it uses those values to make choices. So one of the most interesting things about it are things in the world that seem otherwise equivalent, but where you have big subjective preference differences. Candy bars, various sorts of, you know, TV dinners, and Coke and Pepsi, brown fizzy sugar water. Okay, so one brown fizzy sugar water versus another brown fizzy sugar water. Now people can talk about the subtleties of this. People from those industries can talk on and on about those subtleties. But for me, it was why do people prefer one over the other when they seem to be roughly equivalent at a sort of physical level? Their nervous systems are assigning very different meaning to that. And that seemed like a question that she would be able to answer as a high school intern in the lab.
And she really did. She kept coming back to you and saying...
She did. So the test went something like this. So we used a method of brain imaging called functional magnetic resonance imaging. People are familiar... I don't know if people are familiar with the version that we use. The version that you get at the doctor's office takes a snapshot of your brain, a frozen snapshot. This has been around since about 1982, 83, 84. Very safe technique for imaging your body, your stomach, your knee, your brain. Functional magnetic resonance imaging uses the same machines, but instead of taking a still photograph, it makes a bunch of microscopic blood flow movies. And the reason that's relevant for understanding what parts of your brain are coming on and going off is that in your brain, blood flow is tightly coupled to changes in activity in the neurons that compose your brain. So we now, for about 15 years, it's a very new technique, have a method for eavesdropping safely on healthy human brain activity. That's what my lab did at the time. We used that technique in combination with various kinds of social and cognitive tasks to ask questions. And so that was what she was going to use. And so the experiment was simple. You do a bunch of paired taste tests. One cup unmarked has Coke in it, and one cup unmarked has Pepsi in it. You do the taste test. We see which one they prefer because we know where the Coke and Pepsi are. And we try to correlate this with what they buy in the store. That's the kind of marketing choice in the consumer marketplace part of the experiment. Then they do a similar experiment inside the scanner where they have a pacifier in their mouth that has holes poked in it, and they're lying there and they're seeing images on a screen, and we're squirting Coke and Pepsi in their mouth, and we're looking at the way their brain responds to both the squirts of the fluids and images associated with it. Well, my daughter, her name is Latney, she kept coming to me and saying, I've been calculating this thing you had me calculate, which is what is the correlation between what they do on the taste test with the unmarked cups and what they buy in the store? And the answer is zero. And I said, no. You go ask so-and-so. It was one of my assistants. Go ask him to help you. You're doing it wrong. So this goes on for a while. I hardly even look up from my desk. You know, it's a 16-year-old girl. I figure she doesn't want to work. Eventually, she comes back in and says, I have written MATLAB code, Dad. I have gone to the book. I have figured it out. And the answer is zero. And then she said, you know, maybe the idea of Coke tastes like something. And that's when I remember that. I looked up from my desk and I thought, of course it does. I mean, of course it does. The things that we experience when you drink a bottle of water like we have in front of us here or a sweaty Coke can isn't just a function of the content of the can. It's a function of the expectations that you have based on what you see. It's a function of your body state. Are you thirsty or not? And it's a function of literally the ideas that surround Coca-Cola and the ideas that surround Pepsi-Cola. And then I thought, well, this gives us a way in, and we changed the experiment a good bit to go after, in a sense, the neural basis of the brand image in people's brains. And so it was a high school junior that sort of instigated all this by being sort of a stubborn child who actually did a great job. So she went on that paper.
So is this to say that Coke did a better job of branding and marketing to instill that preference?
I'm sure Coke would like to think that, and I don't know that. I will defer to my expert colleague in the area. What we know, all we know is by the time we got people, and we were in Houston, Texas, which is a great marketing place. It's sort of a giant middle class in Houston. A very diverse demographic cut. And we did, it was a very big experiment. At the time, it was the largest functional imaging experiment in the world. By the time we got them, that was true. And that was true on average for the sample of people that we looked at. We don't know what that means, really. We don't know whether it's because Pepsi did a poor job, Coke did a good job. You couldn't say there's not enough knowledge out there to know it, but it was a fact.
I think this it reflects a lot on the work long term that a brand does to promote itself, to make itself feel relevant to the audiences. It could be that people just felt an affiliation, an affinity to that brand, whether it was through long term advertising, whether they were from Atlanta, in your example. So it has a lot to do with how do I feel about this brand. And even if it tastes different than I think it's going to be, I'm still affiliated to that brand for whatever reason.
I was reading an excerpt from Eckhart Tolle, and he talks about the influences of advertising on people, but just basically how susceptible we are to any external influence. And he says the people in advertising know very well that in order to sell things that people don't really need, they must convince them that those things will add something to how they see themselves or are seen by others. In other words, add something to their sense of self. They do this, for example, by telling you that you will stand out from the crowd by using this product and so, by implication, be more fully yourself. Or they may create an association in your mind between the product and a famous person or a youthful, attractive, or happy-looking person. Even pictures of old or deceased celebrities seem to work. The unspoken assumption is that by buying this product, through some magical act of appropriation, you become more like them. High degree of suggestibility here. We're so malleable, it seems.
Advertising is, as that quote suggests, right? It speaks to the most complicated features of the way we define ourselves and build a self-image, tell a self-narrative, etc. So in that sense, it's the most practical end of the kind of things that we look at as very basic processes. Let me give you an example. There's something called primate status mechanisms. If you go to a troop of rhesus macaque monkeys, you see them standing in a clearing, and you just measure the distances between the monkeys, and you identify the alpha. The betas are standing literally in order in terms of distances from the alpha. They know exactly that. They're deep status mechanisms in our head. Well, the thing about defining your self-image and whatnot almost certainly indexes mechanisms like that. The way they play out in a human being in the context of a complex culture, we don't know. I think, and I want to address this because it has been addressed to me by various anti-commercialism companies. It seems like a misuse of medical research and brain research to go after why is it that we're attracted to one brand over another or one symbol over another. There could be nothing further than the truth. We live in a society where the symbols that induce us to buy whatever things or to eat is awash in almost an epidemic of type 2 diabetes, number one. Body dysmorphic disorders of various sorts, including eating disorders in girls. I happen to have girls who are both athletes, something that's common amongst female athletes, certainly during middle school and whatnot. And then it goes even deeper than that. The way that your brain assigns value to things and the way it uses those valuations to make choices is a capacity that breaks down when you bump the front of your head on a dashboard, when you start to develop Parkinson's disease, and people that have repeated small level but chronic head injuries with, you know, football or boxing or something like that, and various kinds of diseases affect these capacities. Also, these same sensibilities change across the lifespan. They develop in your childhood and through your adolescence and whatnot, and they're different in somebody that's 65 than in somebody that's 25, and it makes the 65-year-old a different kind of decision maker. People like me don't know as much about the sort of real-world decision-making, the kind of things that an ad agency really has a lot of cut-and-tried wisdom from, you know, dealing with the real world, trying to get people to buy things and not buy things, change their behaviors in various ways. But they index mechanisms that disease and injury touches throughout the lifespan in a human being. So in effect, it is a culturally relevant way to probe people's brains, to understand the kind of things that we do want to understand in order to fix them and understand how they develop through the course of the lifespan.
You gave an interesting illustration before our discussion about how we would even put ourselves in peril. If there's enough external cue, we'll do things that are antithetical to our survival.
We're the only creature that does that. If a dog is hungry, a dog will eat. If you feed, I had a dog that I changed its diet once to something that had a lot of kelp in it. And so my dog pouted for a few days, but eventually the dog will eat. A human being can use an abstraction to veto their biological instincts for survival. You can go on a hunger strike for a political idea and literally starve yourself to death.
San Diego,
Rancho Santa Fe, California, 1997. There was a tragedy where a cult called Heaven's Gate committed mass suicide, predicated on the belief that there was a spaceship hiding in the tail of the comet Hale-Bopp. I don't know if people remember this, but it was a dramatically visible comet tail called Hale-Bopp. Almost all of them were college graduates, and all of them had come from families. They had social support, and they were educated. And yet, through whatever you want to attribute this to, you know, let's just keep that blank for now. They had come to acquire this belief. That belief had such a reality in their nervous system, they were able to shut down their capacity to, you know, not overdose on drugs, to not worry about whether they were shot by other members of the cult. I mean, they killed themselves. They suffocated themselves. They put bags over their heads and they taped it. It was horrible. If you start suffocating, you will do anything to survive. That shows the power of thought, okay? That kind of power, it was literally like a behavioral superpower. A species that can do that could eliminate itself if it's not careful, because all of a sudden, the capacity to make cognitive choices now becomes something that's incredibly powerful and flexible in us.
Yeah, and some might argue that we are eliminating ourselves.
Well, yeah, let's wait and see.
You know, advertising has changed so much, just as science has in other functions as well. You know, the days of Don Draper are done. You know, number one, there's a lot more products out there. Used to be you'd have four or five, you know, laundry detergents, and you'd have maybe three or four ways to channel those messages: network TV, broadcast, you know, radio, and obviously a larger newspaper presence. Today, with social media, I mean, that not just is the brain, I think, more faces more complexity when it comes to product choices. But it forces the advertising industry to really zone in on audiences a little bit. I'll walk you through kind of how we go about doing this. This isn't sort of just, hey, we're going to make them buy whatever they want. You know, here's sort of the process we go through. One is obviously we want to identify the target audience, not just the demographics, but the psychographics. What are they thinking? What's their day-to-day like? What needs do they have? Anything from, you know, hey, I've got a busy schedule, I've got kids, and so on and so forth. Those are all things that come into play.
Let's land on that number one for just a second. Yeah. That really blows the image out of a lot of people's minds that, you know, you guys are standing around a piano like the Dick Van Dyke days, and someone walks in and said, hey, I have a good idea for a bit.
Yeah.
This will be a great 30-second spot. It doesn't start that way. It starts with the research.
It does very much start with the research. Ultimately, that can happen. Those creative sparks do happen formed on a basis of research.
Do you have the piano?
No. We have beer in the fridge.
A lot of you guys also have those foosball tables.
There's a lot of creative fun toys in an ad agency typically, and that does play a role because you have long hours. You have to think. You got to get out of the office a little bit and think. Well, once we identify the audience, we take a look at sort of what's important to them, what's their worldview. That talks a little bit about the psychographics. Then we have to frame their story so we know kind of who we're talking about, but what's going to cut through the clutter. And that's important that we understand, number one, that we understand the audience, but two, are they going to be receptive to our message? And then obviously we have to use their language, not just the language that we're speaking in English, but, the language of their region or their culture, things like that. But more importantly, we've got to make sure it connects with them on an emotional level, which is why ultimately you see end products of advertising that have a lot of emotion in it. And humor. Humor has to be used well, but humor can get across because it does transcend some of those messages. It does make people feel inclusive on what you're trying to say. Digital age has tremendously changed our industry.
And I really hope that in our next segment after the break, we'll be able to talk about that too.
Sure.
But and we still have time here, but I really would like to flesh that out because it has truly changed what you do.
It really has. You know, the decision-making process used to be, if you can envision a funnel cloud or a funnel, you'd have many choices. You try to narrow it down based on whatever your decision-making is. And then ultimately, you come to a purchase decision to buy a product or service. Nowadays, people connect with brands in different ways, particularly in the digital world. You have online reviews. You've got word of mouth, which is enormously important. In social media, you've got recommendations from friends. That trumps, in many ways, traditional advertising. The key to good advertising, though, is to hone in on that trend and to be part of that decision making. So now it's not just the funnel cloud. They're considering products. They're expanding their reach in products. But when they do make that buy decision, it's almost like another concentric circle in that they're advocating. They're even arguing for or against the product. They've bought into that brand.
You're listening to Virginia Conversations on Public Radio. And that was the voice of Thomas Becker. He is Senior Vice President with NeatHawk, Dubuque, and Packet. We are also talking with Dr. Reed Montague. He is with the Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute. We will be back in just a moment to continue our discussion. I want to tell you about next week. We'll have a look at a new book called The Idea of America, which celebrates partisan bickering to a point on the next Virginia Conversations. Do stay with us. We're back in a minute. And we are back. Today, we are taking you on an advertising journey, not just externally, but into your brain. Our guests are Dr. Reed Montague of the Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute, a pioneer in the study of neuromarketing, and Thomas Becker, Senior Vice President of the ad agency NeatHawk, Dubuque, and Packet. Let's continue a little bit around the idea of how the internet age, the digital age, has changed advertising. The other thing that I've noticed about it is that you are now able to pinpoint your demographics more accurately than ever.
Yeah, that's the biggest benefit, I think, to the industry as we change. Much like Reed uses research to do his findings and add to the scientific discussion, we have a constant barrage now of research based online to see what works and what doesn't. Is a message getting through? Yeah, we will still do focus groups. We will still do interviews. But now you can test messages so much faster on Facebook, on other mechanisms. You know, online advertising, you can instantly see, is a message being clicked on? Is it being viewed? Do we need to make tweaks to it? So it's constantly changing. The online world has certainly turned things upside down, but we as an industry have adapted. I mean, it's really, in many ways, yes, it's more difficult to get through to people because there's so many more channels, but at the same time, we're able to really, you know, focus, take that research, take what's, you know, before you used to have a long period of developing an ad campaign. Well, that still happens, of course, but now you can tweak it so much faster because of what you see online, what's working, what's not.
And also, ad campaigns look different now.
They certainly do. Again, coming back to the 60s, you know, not only creatively do they look different, but the approach is different. You know, people are so inundated with messages. So how do you stand through, you know, how do you stand out? The digital natives have always known social media, have always known the web. And how to communicate to them is far different than boomers. Boomers are going to be a little bit more loyal to a product. Millennials, this is not a bad thing, are certainly a little bit less loyal. But once they are loyal in general, but they have so many more options. And the way they become loyal is different. They will not listen to a message. They will do their own research. They'll talk to people online. In many ways, if you think about it, the Don Drapers of the world, we used to tell people what to think of a brand. Now it's almost flipped around. Consumers are telling a brand, this is what we want to be, this is where you think you should go.
Okay. Now, I want to make a point of clarification, because when you go online and you look a lot of the literature around neuromarketing, you see Reed's name attached. But I want to replay for you a discussion that Reed and I had. It went something like this. So, Reed, would you provide a working definition of neuromarketing? No. How come? Because that's not what I do. What Reed actually does is he works in the field of decision making and social cognition. This has been attached to you because it's so valuable for people who are in marketing and advertising.
Yes. It's either an appropriate or inappropriate moniker. I'll give you a funny story. So I was called by Ralph Nader's anti-commercialism group after we published the paper on the Coke-Pepsi experiment, where we showed the neural substrates of brand image. And the details of the experiment aren't important. It was the fact that you could turn that issue into a problem and into a measurable signal. You could turn parts of the feelings associated with the idea of Coca-Cola into a bunch of numbers and then use those numbers in, you know, whatever way possible. And so what they saw was, this is a misuse of medical equipment. You're using federal grants to do this. And what you're doing is you're putting into marketers' and advertisers' hands powerful tools where they're going to make us go out and buy stuff that we don't want. Okay. Now, I have no idea what Tom's going to say in response to that. But the fact is, and I don't even know that industry, they don't make you buy stuff that you don't want. Mm-hmm. If products are no good, people don't buy them.
That's right.
That's a misrepresentation, I think, of that side of the industry. But the more important point is, if in fact there was a buy button in your brain, if there was something covert that somebody could do, right, to make you buy something that you didn't want, or make the world, you know, make people in some age group go and take a mortgage that they didn't want, make choices that weren't really sort of consistent with their internal preferences, then I think it's better that people know that and you expose it and you empower the consumer rather than keeping it covert and letting some company go behind and have a trade secret with it that they actually exploit. So I was a strong they were basically trying to bully us, I thought. And so we didn't back down at all. I said, sure, I'll go on. I'll debate him. If you want to sue me, sue me. Because the fact is, these are features of the way our cognition works that lets us navigate our lives, either poorly or the way we want. And we have not understood this very well before. And accordingly, we have not understood how injuries and diseases and congenital disorders or even social settings impress themselves on the way you make choices. We can come all the way back to Heaven's Gate and ask ourselves the question, how could it be that a college graduate with a family of four would ever go from that setting
to a setting where they were wrapping a bag around their head to kill themselves based on an idea that was verifiably false. That seems crazy. It seems important to understand that. And when you think about that's a capacity that we each have, not that we all act on it. If that's a capacity we all have, you might be able to sort of understand it and sort of turn it to good, so to speak. So it has implications up and down the ladder, beyond marketing.
Did the Nader camp back off?
Yep.
Okay.
They backed off of me, but they did not back off of lots of other places. They didn't back off of Emory University. There were congressional hearings on this, and there were open letters written to Congress, et cetera. I mean, they play a role. The anti-commercialism side of Nader's group plays a role. I mean, it's been a good role. On the other hand, the brains that make choices in settings that we find appropriate are also the same brains that decide to get addicted to drugs, the same brains that eat and drink too much, that make poor food and lifestyle choices, that through a trajectory end up with all kinds of disease states. So it's very important to them individually and to society to understand these processes.
So a lot of people will want to know how applicable this is, not just to products, but to political campaigns.
Yes. So I can tell you the techniques used by, I'll give you an example, the techniques used by the Obama campaign to micro-target domains where they knew if we can get everybody here to vote for us, it'll flip the whole state or it'll flip a whole county or it'll flip a whole district. Okay? They used modern machine learning, what are called machine learning techniques, computer programs that learn from experience, lots of big data, and they mined it using both of those things, the big data and the machine learning techniques, to target those sorts of things. Those same techniques are used by people like me to find patterns in the brain that relate to some important cognitive function or to find patterns in group behavior. One of the things that our group studies is how do groups come to have collective behaviors that the individuals may not even know about yet. That's something that we don't understand very well. And I think recent events even would point to why we should and want to understand that.
And that campaign was also very effective in disseminating that information through social media and other means. So in other words, if Obama was a brand, obviously they found ways to get people to identify to that brand. And the digital age was certainly a big part of the last couple of campaigns.
A lot of people say that that's how he was successful, was through the breakthrough of the use of social media, digital media.
Right. Okay. And I think authenticity is important. Today, brands need to be authentic. By that, I mean open, honest, transparent, et cetera. So I think particularly millennials, coming back to that example, found a lot of authenticity in the Obama brand. That was one of the factors, I think, that carried him. And one of the factors why loyalty is maybe less important to them as authenticity. They want to see that a brand that they like or a product that they like are doing the right thing in society, are creating the right products, are paying fair wages, things like that. So there's more in the decision-making, I think, in the brain going on among the millennials because of this digital interaction.
And you're not just pulling these words out of thin air. That actually was done through polling to determine what's important to you. Well, authenticity.
Authenticity is important. We mentioned research. Research is so critical. We don't just go ahead and just, boom, create an ad. And I wish it was that easy. I mean, you have to go through this process of research. I described earlier, you have to have a lot of conversations with the target audience. You have to see what fits, what doesn't. And this isn't necessarily always a case of trying to get people to buy something they don't need. It's about changing perceptions. It's about, whether it's a political campaign or something local. It is about, identifying change and how to affect that change.
I'm going to toss it back to you, Reed. Our producer popped his head in and had a really great question about how one might be able to counter the effects of these external cues. Can someone train their mind to not be affected by these messages?
Well, yes and no. It depends on the nature of the message. There's some messages that are too important to be able to train your mind to ignore, like sex and food. So if you're able to affect a culture, a species, it's able to ignore sex and food, well, there are not so many of those left anymore. So, we didn't eat and we didn't reproduce. There's a community called the Shaker community in Massachusetts, which I went and visited, and they make a lot of very fine handmade furniture. And they have one of their beliefs is they have a prohibition against sex. And so so you have to kind of recruit the Shakers. And then there's this problem of attrition because Shakers don't make other Shakers. They have to go get them. And needless to say, it's a very small community.
It's a dwindling community.
You can give you an example.
that actually relates to this whole issue of symbols and branding. So we've done an experiment where we ask where there's no right answer. We've done an experiment where we ask people to rate, to look first look at pieces of art, Western art, representational and non-representational art. We just flash them randomly for random periods of time on random time boundaries to people. Afterwards, we say, we have this other experiment we want you to do. And they're asked to consciously rate them, sort of -5 to +5 scale, to how much you like or dislike this piece of art. And then we go back into their brains and we say, show us brain responses that would, when we were initially flashing these pictures before they knew they were going to rate them, that would have predicted the ratings that they made. And you can get very good predictors out of that. But that's not the experiment we did. That's not the question we asked. We then did the following. We created a bunch of online companies. We registered the names. We put money in the accounts, but made up by us, like Webnetters and Nouveau Rico or something. We made up all these terms and logos. And at the beginning of the experiment, it said, Webnetters has paid $300 for you to do this experiment. So the $300 you're making in this experiment, which everybody made in the first set, is being paid by Webnetters, and you see the logo. Then we place the logo of the sponsoring company and or the logo of a non-sponsoring company by pieces of art. So there's no right answer to what you like in a piece of art. There's also no reciprocity there. In other words, whether or not you are sitting next to a sponsoring logo, there's no sense in which you're paying the company back. Okay, long story short, if you're next to a sponsoring logo, it shifts your entire preference curve up.
You prefer the piece of art
you
that's sponsored.
You prefer the Kandinsky sitting next to the sponsoring logo, and you don't prefer it anymore sitting next to a non-sponsoring logo. For the ones that you don't like, it shifts them rightward. It makes them less not liked by you. Okay? It's a profound effect. We've repeated the experiment many times. We've published lots of papers on it.
Why do we care? Why do we care whether something's sponsored or not?
I don't think that's the way to think about it.
Okay.
I think that it's like an information harvesting mechanism. This thing over here did something nice for me. If it goes, suppose it's a person. Suppose Tom does something nice for me. Okay. And then now Tom goes and runs over to another field that I often don't visit. And I see him cavorting with other individuals that I don't usually. And he seems safe. So Tom's nice to me. Tom goes out and explores the world. I assign extra value out to those people over there because he seems to like them. So I've gotten information about an extended piece of the world back without having to go do it. That's how we use social bonds and those kinds of social gestures. That's a favor experiment, right? The company does a favor for the person. It leaves over this afterglow. We think it's part of information harvesting, like I just described there. But it's a profound effect. So what gets rid of it? Okay. Well, two things. One of two things will get rid of this effect. The first is you're an art expert. You hate everything. Okay. If you're an art expert, you're not subject to this sponsorship effect. Or if you've done mindfulness-based meditation training.
All right.
Which is basically just, and we actually have now whittled it down to, we actually think it's you're just able to focus on your breathing and think inside. So people that do mindfulness-based training are not susceptible to this sponsorship effect at all. It completely eliminates it. Okay, so that's just a small example of the kind of thing one might do to gain a little bit more control over the way you make choices and the degree to which you are susceptible to things that may be barraging you during the day.
And that's a nod to the Eckhart Tolle readers. Just heard his excerpt earlier.
It also, I think, speaks to the fact that these days advertising alone is not enough. I mean, we're an integrated firm. We do public relations. We do events and sponsorships and all these things. So I think you have to look at it as, you know, how do you touch people in different ways? It's not just the traditional advertising. You know, 90% of advertising budgets do go to sort of advertising, this sort of thing. But what people are forgetting is the importance of you know, the digital era, the social connectivity of word of mouth, of referrals, of people talking about products with their friends. That has so much value. But to get to that point, you have to do more than just advertising.
There is a real great example of that, the social implication, and that is why people would pay inordinately more amounts of money for something that is a designer piece of clothing,
right,
versus something that is of equal value or, let's say, equal quality, which would cost a lot less but doesn't have that designer label attached to it.
Yeah, fashion is particularly an example of that just because of the trends of fashion. I personally don't understand that in my own brain because I'm not privy to those things. But it does come back to associating with the brand. So if in your mind, if I wear XYZ brand, I'm going to do this and this. So you're going to think, what's the benefit of me to pay the extra? Am I going to look better? Am I going to be with a better crowd? You know, that would be a fascinating subject from a brain perspective. But people want to associate with a brand even if it costs them more.
Because the brand has attached to it all of these other things. Like you just mentioned, if someone has done something for you. You've mentioned if you have a social connection to it.
Right. And are they part of that brand promise? Does a company say, if you buy our product, you're going to be kind of this? And there's a lot of decision making that goes into that.
And there's value in status.
Yeah.
There's serious monetary return value in status, both in mates and money and jobs and opportunity. You're standing next to primates of every sort, including us, love to stand next to high status individuals. Because good things happen in the realm of that. So if you associate with that with a piece of clothing, a person like me, it would help me if I looked more like Brad Pitt. Yeah, probably would. I'd probably get more jobs and offers if I was 4 inches taller. An inch extra in height on men is worth about $15,000 a year in salary.
And that's men.
That's men.
Okay.
The women problem is more difficult because of traditional subordination of women through in the workplace and whatnot, and they still make 82 cents on a dollar than men. But the fact is, these features of our mentation are covert, right? Why would you want to buy a designer brand? Well, probably if I were going to guess, if I were answering a multiple choice test, I would start with status, and the fact that status brings all this other stuff. So it really has real value. It's irrational.
And part of that too, I think, is the inordinate coverage of celebrities and celebrity award shows and, oh, look at that handbag. I got to get one of those. I think that comes into play as well.
But before there were celebrities, there were kings and queens.
Sure.
And people in charge and Genghis Khan. And I'd rather be standing beside Genghis Khan than, under some yoke of Genghis Khan's mad at me.
You are listening to Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio. This reminder that past editions of Virginia Conversations can be heard at virginiapublicradio.org. We are talking with Dr. Reed Montague of Virginia Tech Carilion Institute, Research Institute, and he's the one who would be standing next to Genghis Khan. He's the one you just heard from. And Thomas Becker, Senior Vice President at NECOC, Dubuque, and Packet. We will be back in just a moment with our continued conversation on neuromarketing and the art of advertising.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, supporting public discourse through sponsorship of Virginia Public Radio. Resources for parents and teachers online at veanea.org. More information about Virginia Conversations and other Virginia Public Radio programming can be found online at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.
And we are back. We are talking about neuromarketing and the art of advertising. Our guests today are Dr. Reed Montague of the Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute and Thomas Becker, Senior Vice President at NECOC, Dubuque, and Packet. You talked about the height issue. 1 inch equals $15,000 a year increase
for men.
And it reminds me of the study about voice. That is, whether it is a man or a woman, the deeper the voice, the more the credibility. The more perceived credibility. It didn't matter whether they actually had more credibility.
Or accent.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have another lab in London, and, if you have an English accent, you get
an extra IQ points for a West German or an English accent, right? I mean, but if you have a Southern accent, you start in the hole. They take off IQ points. You got to work your way up.
So I got to start talking in a deep voice in a British accent.
Yes. I felt a surge of testosterone when you said that.
And it has to be the right accent. It has to be European.
Well, that helps.
Yeah.
That helps. I'm from Atlanta. And although I've lost much of my liquid Georgia accent, it doesn't help. On the other hand, that's why Southern businessmen are good. If you want to think, you know, they'll let you think they're dumb. You want to think I'm dumb? That's okay.
You are from Atlanta, and when you started talking about the Nader folks coming after you, I thought you were going to tell us that the Coke folks came after you, Atlanta being so Coke-based, because of your Pepsi Coke issues.
No, actually, the most interesting feature of the Coke-Pepsi experiment, it actually wasn't the Nader folks. It was called Commercial Alert, which was his anti-commercialism group, but it's his brainchild. Neither company has ever contacted me. In fact, we were very fastidious about... We knew the effect it was going to have when we knew we had this really this nice finding. So we wouldn't have taken any calls or even money or anything like that. But since that, neither company has ever contacted me. I think it's a bit of the unknown. I think neuromarketing, as it's evolved in the commercial place, Tom maybe can speak to this, has made a lot of claims, which haven't really panned out. So it's still a lot more hype than it is reality. So I've not seen a real powerful practical application, but it will be coming. I mean, brain imaging and our knowledge of cognition and our models are progressing rapidly to the extent that we will have to start thinking about privacy issues when it comes to eavesdropping on people's thoughts. Not now, but certainly in the next 30 years, I would say. That's going to be an up-and-coming issue. But maybe he could comment on whether there have been practical applications. I doubt it.
You know, it's rarely a simple thing when you're talking about messages. You know, not only are you trying to tell a story, it's more than just the logo. People think, well, brand's the logo. It's not. It's just a lot more that goes into it. So you have to have some kind of connection to that brand loyalty. I mean, I think your research shows awareness, maybe a brand awareness. But, you know, does it show engagement? I mean, what we do on the advertising side is make a difference. We get people to engage or buy or act, whatever the goal is to be. So being aware, brand aware or cause aware is not enough. You have to, you know, act on it. My question to you is, let's say you showed a bottle of Coke or something to someone in the Amazon or whatever who's never, you know, seen it. There's no awareness.
It's meaningless.
It's meaningless.
Yes.
So
it could be,
obviously,
it's an arbitrary image.
Right. So obviously, the brands have done a nice job with awareness, but doesn't necessarily mean action. That's where you have to kind of dig deeper and come up with messages that are going to resonate with them.
That's an important point. Human beings pass a lot of very important survival information socially. So, for example, we heard a talk yesterday at the Institute from an expert on emotion and, in particular, fear conditioning. Okay? You see a rattlesnake, you freeze. You know, something bad happens to you, you run away, all that kind of thing. Well, you don't actually have to go out and experience every bad thing in the world, because another human can say, hey, don't cross that river there. My cousin died there. Don't turn over the big green rocks because it has those poisonous spiders under it. Okay? And that's enough. And credibility in that space is something that we have evolved to be able to assess and respond to. And so the social transmission of very deep level values like that is already built into us. We know how to value stuff like that. So while a person from Papua New Guinea, but I bet you Coca-Cola has a presence there.
Probably.
Yeah, okay, right. I bet you if we could walk into the jungles there, you might find Coke cans or bottles.
Cocaine.
But let's imagine that it were true, that they hadn't. It's an arbitrary symbol, but it could come to gain value because somebody gives it to you, tells you it's valuable, somebody of high status starts using it, and that kind of thing. Those are really important features of the way our brain works. Let me give you an example. We have one of the things that we work on is drug addiction, because drug addiction, drugs of abuse, every drug of abuse impacts a system in your brain called the dopamine system. Dopamine is a neurochemical in your brain that's associated with rewards, food, water, sex, and salt. And the symbols that come to predictable rewards, Coca-Cola, high status individuals, things that you like, that sort of thing. Dopamine systems are affected by nicotine, by opiates, by cocaine, by methamphetamine, on and on. It's a powerful system that controls the way you do motivated learning. Well, people that become addicted to drugs, those drugs potentiate the impact of dopamine far beyond its natural
operation limits. Okay, so it's like whatever you just did was 1,000 times more valuable than everything you've ever been doing in your whole life. Okay, some brains are more susceptible to this than others. We all know this. However, the whole idea of suggestibility in messages also impacts the dopamine system. So you can take a smoker, and you can tell them the cigarette you're smoking has nicotine, or you can tell them the cigarette you're smoking does not have nicotine. And you can give them what are called placeboized cigarettes, cigarettes where all the indicators of whether there's nicotine in them or not have been removed. So some of them have nicotine and some of them do not. Nicotine is a very powerful drug, even in a smoker. And I can put them in a state where the message itself dominates brain responses in evolutionarily old region of your brain over the nicotine itself. So the message itself comes to have value in low-level structures in your brain that are put there to make you go after food, water, sex, and salt.
That's pretty remarkable. You're saying that with no nicotine present, all your mind needs to hear is that there is nicotine.
Actually, it's the other way around. If you don't have nicotine and you're craving nicotine, all your nervous system looking for is nicotine. And the statement, the suggestion has no impact, but you put a little nicotine on board, so you're a little bit sated or completely sated, then the suggestion has all the impact. Okay.
Wow.
Understanding how suggestions like that come to impact people's behavior is the essence to understanding drug addiction. A drug addict is exactly someone who cannot conjure the future negative consequences of what's going to go on and use that to intervene on their present drug-taking actions, right? Well, we don't understand that yet. And we don't understand why therapies don't work, and they don't work. Recidivism rates for any kind of drug rehab centers are in the 80 to 90 percentiles, and that's being generous, okay? And we don't really understand why people backslide there. And these are motivated people. So the idea that this is just an interesting confluence. The things that advertisers have been doing for, you know, as long as there have been advertisers, and the things that neuroscientists are now interested in are bumping into one another. And the thing that really ties us together is social networking. People are doing experiments in my domain using Twitter feeds and Facebook pages and all kinds of social aggregation media that you could use to be able to gather data that you never had access to before.
Right.
Let's apply this discussion to body image. We touched on it briefly, but we have anorexia, bulimia. It serves to reason, based on what you've said, that if a person can retrain themselves to view their body in a different way, I mean, an anorexic girl, mostly girls are afflicted with this, will look at her body and see someone fat. So her brain has already been acculturated into thinking this. And so it sounds like some brain retraining could make all the difference.
That's what we think. In fact, we have a collaboration with somebody at University of Texas Southwestern on exactly this, females with body dysmorphic disorder or eating disorders. And there's a big overlap there. And the way in which symbols that portend what you think you see come to have value in your nervous system. So we don't understand that. And it is, the culture is a big part of that. Turn the clock back 1,000 years, and it was the plump women that signaled opulence. They were the ones that didn't have suntans and had fat on them were the ones that had the money and the wherewithal to be able to be that way. Everybody else had to work. Okay, so where's the disorder there? I mean, my point is that the culture becomes this information processing device. It stores what went on before. It stores our values. It transmogrifies. Shifts our values around, it pumps it right back into nervous systems. And so a lot of these things that we're encountering now and that we don't know how to deal with is not just a problem of understanding the brain, it's also understanding the brain socially situated in a culture. And that's been hard to study. Just a few groups around the country are able to sort of take those things on board, I think, because standard neurobiology has been thought of as being a real sort of applied science where you're looking at the parts of the brain and whatnot. But the fact is there is something like software running in your head, even though there are also parts, the biology of which you would like to know. But these things marry in the production of your mind, and they certainly marry at the level of the way the culture presses itself in on you and navigates your life in ways that you don't want it to, or navigates your children's lives in ways you don't want. And so it's an interesting time for science to take on problems that seem very practical, advertising, for example, and ally themselves with non-traditional partners. So while I disavow, in a sense, and you could tell this, I'm not a neuromarketer. I mean, if you knew me very well, you'd know I'm the farthest thing from a marketing person there is. But the fact is, they do have something to say to me. Those industries are at the end or at on some trajectory of a lot of cut and tried experiments, right? They've tried a bunch of stuff. They kind of know things that work. The things they say, just their explanations aren't necessarily useful to me for mechanism in the brain, but that's where we come in. And so we have come to start listening to various of these applied domains, and there's an alliance for making health choices. Consumers now, people are really consumers of healthcare now because the information's out there. When I was a kid, you just went in and they pulled your teeth and they said, well, we needed to do that. Or they gave you a shot and you don't even know what's in the shot. Okay, that just doesn't happen anymore. You go in and you're armed with a bunch of knowledge, and the doctors are a little bit on their heels trying to defend themselves and defend their choices. And that's a good thing. That's a good dialogue.
That's an example of, I think, consumers being empowered. Whether it's buying a car or looking at healthcare options, they know a lot more than consumers in the past.
Yeah. I want to go to an article by Mary Carmichael of Frontline. I'll read this, get your reaction to it. She addresses you, Dr. Montague. She says, getting an update on research is one thing. For decades, marketers have relied on behavioral studies for guidance, but some companies are taking the practice several steps further, commissioning their own fMRI studies, like yours, Dr. Montague. In a study of men's reactions to cars, Chrysler has found that sportier models activate the brain's reward centers, the same areas that light up in response to alcohol and drugs, as well as activating the area in the brain that recognizes faces, which may explain people's tendency to anthropomorphize their cars. Hmm. Fascinating. We see our cars as so much more than a vehicle to get where they're going.
That's, you know, if you look back to the classic 1960s campaign for VW, you know, smaller, cars are always just an extension of the persona. And I think it brings in so many emotions and so many messages that it's sort of a specialty in its own, you know, automobile marketing.
Right. And it's fascinating to look at the gender differences. Yep. Guys tend to care more than girls tend to.
But I know that particular study. And I guess I would respond by saying, do we really need to look inside the brain to know that young men like fast cars and associate their egos with it? I mean, come on.
Yeah. I was meeting with a retired pilot not too long ago, and I couldn't find which hangar. He said, I'll be in the Jaguar. So just look for me at the gate, and I'll be near this hangar. I finally had to call his wife. And I said, could you tell me what color is his Jaguar? Because I can't find him. She said, honey, he has six Jaguars.
Yeah. So understanding how your brain processes reward and values things, certainly like cars. The part about the car, for example, lighting up the face recognition area. The face recognition area that they're talking about would also come on if you were looking at a washing machine. It's part of what's called a ventral visual pathway. And so any complex object that had a role in your life that you were familiar with and liked. So if you're the Maytag repairman, that same so-called face area will turn on when I show you a Maytag washing machine. Okay. So that's a particularly interesting study in that Tom would be able to say everything that was relevant to say about it, except that these valuation systems propagate all the way up to the front of your head, a region that's susceptible to closed head trauma and accidents. When you hit your head or when you're in a war and you have a concussive blast, your orbital frontal cortex, right, the area right between your eyes, is particularly susceptible to injury. And when you damage that area, you can't value things very well and you have a hard time making decisions. It impairs your ability to be a normal person in the normal world. So that's the sense in which the brain study is informative. The young man in fast cars thing, you know, you probably could have guessed it behaviorally. So,
what about subliminal advertising? Is that a thing of the past?
I think it is. I think I talked earlier about authenticity in a brand. People will see through that with social media and communications and dialogue among friends and colleagues and so on. I think people can cut through that real fast and call brands out on that.
But also, wasn't there an outcry against blatant subliminal advertising? That's a great oxymoron. And so we just don't see it practiced. You know, when you used to pull out a magazine ad and you'd see in the image these hidden subtexts. Does that still exist?
Not that I know of. They outlawed forms of it in the 70s in movie theaters and whatnot. But now, I mean, there's this ad now about a guy selling Dos Equis beer. The most interesting man in the world.
I love that ad. Yeah.
I'm the most interesting man in the world. I don't drink beer, but when I do, I drink Dos Equis. I mean, it's so blatant that it's funny and you don't forget it. And so I think Tom
it also speaks to, hey, I want to be like that guy.
That's right.
You know, I want to be like that guy.
But they're so blatant about it. Nobody's trying to sort of slip one past you with that.
Right. And that's what authenticity is about. I don't think companies can get away with it these days.
The Old Spice commercial with the guy on the boat.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Well, the boat, the motorcycle,
like
the waterfall.
Right. Well, yeah, well, the one that I'm thinking of is he's on the boat and you want your man to smell like the man that I am.
That's right.
Or something like that. It's good. Because it does make fun of some of these larger-than-life characters that we've been, you know, exposed to over the years. Well, that is all the time we have for this edition of Virginia Currents Conversations. And you'll notice there wasn't one single ad during this entire discussion of ads.
Nor call.
Nor call. I want to thank our guests, Dr. Reed Montague of the Virginia Tech Carilion Research Institute, and Thomas Becker, Senior Vice President at Nehawk, Dubuque, and Packet. Is there any way you guys can simplify that name?
NDNP.
All right, NDNP. Thank you so much, and we look forward to seeing you next week on Virginia Conversations. Until then, I'm Aileen Lee. Have a great week.
Virginia Conversations on Virginia Public Radio is underwritten by the Virginia Education Association, the men and women working in Virginia's public schools. VEA, teaching, learning, leading. Online at veanea.org. And by listeners of this Virginia Public Radio member station. Listeners can hear this program again or access other Virginia Public Radio news content at virginiapublicradio.org. This is Virginia Public Radio.